Daddy and Dan and I are going away, Griffey, for a little. We're going on a trip. You're going to stay with Grandpa and Grandma. Pop and Grandma, okay?
Sometimes I worry that Griffin's going to fall in love with some woman who just lays in bed all the time because that's what he sees his mother doing in the first 2 years of his life. I mean, he's going to fall in love with some woman who lies in bed and eats bonbons or something, or reads or something, because that seems to be what I'm turning into, is this person who lies in bed all the time. Or else I lie on the couch and read him books or something.
Yeah, yo. Once there were three baby owls, Sarah, Percy, and Bill. They lived in a hole in the trunk of a tree with their mother owl. The hole had twigs and leaves and owl feathers in it. It was their house. One night they woke up and their mother owl was gone. Where's Mommy? Said Sarah. Oh, my goodness, said Percy. I want my Mommy, said Bill.
He really likes the owl book, and it makes him feel better, you know, that in the owl book the Mommy owl goes away, but then she comes back. So I think he understands that. And lots of mothers go away on trips and go off for work for weeks at a time. And I've had to do that. Now the really bad one is I'm going to have to go away for, you know, a month or more. And he'll hopefully come visit. But still, you know, it's going to be a really long time. I mean, it happens, but... And I guess the most important thing is that I get well so that he can have a mother.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye, Griffey. We'll see you soon, okay? Bye-bye. You stay with Grandpa and Mom, okay?
Say bye-bye.
Okay. You go to Papa. Want to go to Papa?
No.
Yes.
Sweetie. Bye-bye. We'll see you later.
We'll see you soon.
You're going to the park with Marta. Look,
bye-bye, Mommy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Daddy.
Bye-bye. Bye, Greedy. You'll be okay.
Bye-bye.
It arrives and it disappears. Driving down sunny 44 highway, there's a beach there known for cancer waiting to happen.
There are at least three reasons why I was supposed to be exempt from getting seriously sick. First, Tom, my partner of 10 years and the father of our son, Griffin, had a kidney transplant in 1988, so he's supposed to be the one with the health problems in our family. If I ever envisioned myself in a hospital, it was standing at his bedside. Second, about 6 years ago, my older brother, Josh, was diagnosed with leukemia, and I don't think anyone expected two serious cancer patients in our family. Third, I'm a health reporter, and though my focus has always been on patients and how they're affected by our health care system, I never thought I would end up as one of these people.
And they're off on a big road trip.
You got your warm coat?
Yeah.
Okay, we got lots of turkey sandwiches.
Maybe it was a little crazy to drive all the way to Omaha in the dead of winter, but I hate to fly, and Tom likes road trips. I think we were determined to make the trip fun. Driving would give us a sense of where we were going. Plus, we got to stop at the Waffle House.
We're in the bathroom of the Waffle House. Did you lock the door?
Yeah.
And I'm going to give myself an injection of Neuprogen. It's just like being a heroin addict.
For me, it was the worst part, having to give myself shots. For one thing, it hurt. And it was a symbol of what I was going through.
And then the funnest part is you jab it into your leg. Like so, and then you just push it in, and sometimes it hurts and sometimes it doesn't. It sort of depends on where you get it in the leg. Voila. And that's it. I used to do it at home. When I had to do it for like 10 days, I do it at like 7:25, right before Seinfeld. So if it took me more than 5 minutes to do it, I'd miss Seinfeld, so I'd hurry myself along. See, now I'm doing it right before I get to eat at Waffle House, so give myself a treat afterwards.
BLC on wheat.
Mmm. Chicken melt. Oh, boy.
December 1st. After 3 days on the road, we make it to Omaha.
Have a seat and we'll be with you just a minute, okay?
I'm feeling pretty rotten from the ill effects of my final round of chemotherapy back in Washington. They messed up at the hospital. The line that was supposed to administer the chemo wasn't in the right place, so the drugs went into my belly instead of my bloodstream. Because of this, my bladder hurts and I'm tired, and I'm about to embark on a nasty, exhausting journey. I feel as if I need more strength. But here we go.
Yeah, we're going to do your EKG right in this room.
Okay.
The first week in Omaha felt like boot camp. I shuffled from one test to another.
3 more seconds. Keep going. A couple more breaths. Stop. Good. Good test.
Endless poking and prodding.
Okay, Rebecca, you're going to feel a poke and a burn. This is the numbing medication.
There's a tiny little poke. I'm sorry. Your skin's a tiny bit tough.
One more to go after this, honey. It's not bothering you, is it? Okay.
Just tired of being poked and prodded and pricked and, you know, achy and tired. This is supposed to be the easy time. I can't imagine it being any worse.
Tomorrow. Don't eat or drink after midnight tonight. Tomorrow at 8 o'clock, you'll go down to the first floor of the hospital to special x-rays.
Kathy Beyer was my nurse coordinator. She seemed more interested in keeping me on schedule than in what I was going through. We called her my drill sergeant.
You know, I would imagine it does feel like that because you lose that control. All of a sudden you're coming to a strange institution. They're telling you when, where, and what to do. And, you know, as a person that's young, independent, used to having her own kind of control, it's very frustrating.
I'm a medical reporter, so I was used to asking a lot of questions. And maybe they just weren't used to pushy New Yorkers in Omaha.
You got to get me on a later schedule. I'm too exhausted.
And I didn't like Kathy's cheerleading.
Positive attitude! Positive attitude! You're not going to feel sick.
I just wasn't in the mood, you know. I'd been through a lot already, and I was tired, and I remember she would say, you know, positive attitude, and I just felt like hell, you know. I had a positive attitude the first time around, and, you know, it didn't work. I mean, now I was going through something even worse, and it was hard for me to keep positive.
You're not going to feel sick. Not gonna get sick.
One coping mechanism I did have was to act like a health reporter. I was obsessed with the numbers. It was really important for me to know the odds that the transplant would work. Those odds were about 50-50. So sometimes, sitting in a room with other patients, I couldn't help but think that only about half of us were going to make it. And this made it kind of hard to get close to people. But Graham and his family was an exception.
Hi, I'm Graham Brazier. I'm here for a bone marrow transplant because of multiple myeloma, which was a disease that was diagnosed in May of 96.
Graham was a young father facing worse odds than me.
The latest statistics are that 3 years out from transplant, 35% are disease-free, as they call it.
His wife, Lorraine, was playing the support role and caring for their 9-month-old red-headed son, Thomas. Even though I admired Lorraine for being able to be a mom there at the hospital, and even though Thomas made me miss Griffin, I was glad Griff wasn't there. He was older than Thomas. He was nearly a year and a half. I was afraid that if he were there with me, he would understand too much, and I didn't want him to have to understand anything.
Hi, Griefy!
So I settled for the occasional phone call.
Hey, Griefy, want me to sing macaroni?
I have a little pony, his name is Macaroni. He trots and trots and then he stops. My funny little pony, Macaroni. Do you like that song, Griefy?
I don't know. In a lot of ways, I guess I have kind of removed myself from him because I know, you know, I have to go through this and do this and sort of like something I have to do before I can really, you know, be with him for real or have the energy for him for real. So a lot of times I don't have the energy for him, and that makes it easier to kind of separate from him.
Griefy, I miss you. I'll see you soon. I love you. I love you, Griefy.
December 10th. We get some bad news. The CAT scan shows the most recent round of chemotherapy back in Washington hasn't shrunk the tumor nearly at all. Julie Vos is my doctor in Omaha.
Rebecca still has a mass found in her CT scan, so we're going to administer another cycle of salvage chemotherapy that's a slightly different type to try and reduce that mass further down before she actually undergoes a transplant. And we found in the past that this is a best way to try and have the best long-term outcome for patients.
The good news is I'm actually feeling much better. So that night, we celebrate.
After drawing out all his water,
that's how Maggie. We're even out at a restaurant, not just any restaurant, but a find of a restaurant, this Catfish Lodge here in Omaha, with the white albino catfish in the tank in the middle. I'm actually feeling good tonight. It's like a miracle. I haven't felt like this. I'm not like crying or in pain or something.
Two days later, I begin the Omaha chemo.
They give you four drugs. And one of them is blue. I kind of like the blue one because it's just so startling. It looks like, you know, blue food coloring kind of color. Or like blueberry frozen popsicle melted.
And you said that you dressed accordingly today?
Yes, I wore my blue pants to go with the blue. My electric blue pants to go with the electric blue poison.
The American Cancer Society offers classes in how you can look better and feel better, and though it sounded hokey at the time, now I understand why they do this. Getting sick really played havoc with my body image. I felt as if my body had betrayed me, like a separate person I couldn't trust. My sexual desire went out the window. I figured I wouldn't mind losing my hair, because at least it wouldn't hurt. But looking at myself in the mirror was like looking at a Holocaust victim, all skin and bones. Actually, I've always been tiny and scrawny, but I never minded before. So I avoided mirrors and wore a hat, even when the weather got warm. I did break down and let Tom style the little bit of fuzz that was still left on my head.
This is the weapon. It's small, but very effective. You see, I gotta do a little experimental swat here.
Don't be doing this, Tom!
I'm not. Trust me, just trust me.
I just had a CT scan. They're looking to compare the tumor in the chest to how it was like in October, see if it's shrunk.
The blue chemo hasn't shrunk the tumor either, so finally it's time to get on with the bone marrow transplant.
I mean, it's discouraging that the tumor hasn't shrunk any. I was hoping, you know, it would shrink with these last bunch of chemos, so I'm just anxious to get done, and I'm hoping it's really going to work, and I'm kind of wondering about what's the chances it's really going to work. I mean, they can't be as good as they would be if the tumor had shrunk a lot.
It's okay if we go ahead and get your consent form signed today, so we're all ready to go when you're ready to go?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The consent form is a reminder of what I'm in for. It lists all sorts of nasty things that could and sometimes do happen when you have a bone marrow transplant. Kidney failure, liver failure, heart failure.
It sounds really scary, and that's because we have to put every little last thing in here that could possibly happen. That doesn't mean it's going to happen, but we have to let you know that's a real possibility.
It didn't help to see the transplant patients who were a week or two ahead of me. They had just been where I was going, and they looked so weak shuffling into the clinic. But our friend Graham had his transplant 2 days ago, and he seems to be doing pretty well.
Everybody seems to be different, and some people I understand end up on ventilators. But the worst thing I experienced up there, apart from the nausea, was lockjaw. And that was, you know, just a strange sensation where your jaw freezes up and your tongue starts sucking down your throat.
People on the transplant unit seem to fall into two groups. There are the ones who get their chemo and get out, and there are the ones who get infections and end up on respirators. This winter, a lot of patients have gotten influenza. They're on respirators, and they're taking a long time to recover. There's a shortage of beds, so I wait, spending most of my time inside the clean, cozy apartment we've rented. I sit on the rose-covered couch and watch the sparrows out the window. It's very cold.
WOWWOWFM, Omaha Council Bluffs. Good morning, I'm Mike Bradley. The Omaha metro area, as well as other areas in east central Nebraska and northern Nebraska and all of southwest Iowa, under a winter storm warning for blowing snow and dangerous wind chills, down to 65 to 70 below zero.
As we wait, I'm thinking about what's going to happen. Even though they call it a bone marrow transplant, which conjures up images of long dagger-like needles being jabbed into the spine, actually they collect the bone marrow or stem cells from my blood with a contraption much like a dialysis machine. The machine borrows your blood, culls it for stem cells, and then gives it back. It's the stem cells that produce red cells, white cells, and platelets, all of which will be wiped out by the high doses of chemo. Dr. Ruth Kessinger pioneered the treatment in Omaha.
The machine empties the cells into a very important special bag. And we take the bag of cells to the laboratory. And in the laboratory, we freeze them in a liquid nitrogen freezer and save them there. Then the patient can go get his or her high-dose therapy. The high-dose therapy, of course, is intended to kill tumor cells, but the doses are so high that it also hurts the bone marrow, and that's the reason you need to give these stem cells back to the patient so they can grow a new bone marrow. So as soon as the high-dose therapy is finished, and hopefully the cancer is finished too, it's been killed, then we get the cells out of the freezer, we thaw them, and we simply inject them back into the bloodstream of the patient. And like a miracle, these stem cells know where to go. They home right to the bone marrow, the empty bone marrow space, and begin to grow.
Hi, can I help you?
Hi, I'm supposed to be admitted.
Oh, okay. What's the name?
Rebecca Pearl.
Pearl?
Mm-hmm. I think of it kind of like a pregnancy and like having a child, like the birth. I mean, like no one can tell you what it's going to be like. You kind of know it's going to be awful, or that's what a lot of people say. And no, but nobody can really tell you what it's really going to be like, and everyone's experience is really different, and it's just sort of like you don't have a choice, you're just going to do it, you know, it's just going to happen. And I just sort of feel like with this, it's the same thing. It's like this momentum, and it's just going to happen, and I'm going to do it. I mean, it's scary, but I'm just going to do it.
My room looks like you could wash it down with a hose, like a vet's examining room. It's an awful mustardy yellow. It overlooks a graveyard. I'm here for 5 days while they pour deadly medicines into my veins.
I would say in the next 4 days or so, about 3 to 4 days from now, she's going to feel pretty sick to her stomach and maybe have some loose stools and some mouth sores developing once all this chemo builds up in her system.
Everybody have fun tonight. Everybody. Everybody have fun tonight.
In the hospital, there's the official information that the staff doles out, and there's the unofficial grapevine, tips and advice that patients share with each other. From the veteran patients, I hear that the University of Nebraska Medical Center doesn't like to give out Zofran, an anti-nausea drug that's very expensive but works like a charm when you're getting chemotherapy. So I start to insist on it to everyone I see. I tell the nurses.
I'd like to have Zofran.
Okay.
Because that's what's worked for me in the past.
The residents.
That means that I really do want Zofran because I know that works for me. When I had Isha.
And the head doctor.
I just feel like I've said this to so many people so many times. It's not, I want to get Zofran every day.
Despite my requests, my demands, my begging, the first night they fail to give me Zofran. And like Graham, my jaw stiffens up, a side effect of a cheaper, less effective anti-nausea drug. It's a reminder of what it means to be a patient. You can ask, but sometimes you have very little power. During my high-dose chemo, I find out that Graham is back in the hospital on a ventilator. They think he has pneumonia and sepsis, an infection of the blood that is common in hospitals and quite serious for transplant patients. Tom and Dan keep giving me updates about Graham's condition, but I don't really want to know.
I kind of like to be a little bit removed from how everybody else is doing.
Why?
Because it's scary. It's hard for me to hear every detail of how everyone else is doing. So all that could be happening to me.
The staff really did try to help me cope, and I did appreciate how genuinely nice Midwesterners are. But sometimes I just couldn't get with the program. Twice, rabbis came into my room and left their business card and told me if I ever wanted to talk. And it was very awkward because they were there to sort of try to, you know, I don't know, solicit important things out of me about how I was feeling. And I just didn't want to have any part of it. And they kept asking me, you know, the social worker, when I first went into the hospital, she would say, you know, well, are you involved in any religion? And I'd say, no. And then she would say, well, I don't mean organized religion, but just, you know, your own spirituality. I'd say, no. And she'd say, well, what about, you know, some sort of mystical or, you know, some other culture kind of, are you involved in it? And I'd say, no. And, you know, just sort of no to all her questions. And I think she just didn't know exactly what to make of that because I don't think almost anybody had ever said no to all her questions. What worked for me was to work. One of the reasons I wanted to do this documentary was to have a distraction. It was a way to think of myself as a journalist, a working person, as opposed to somebody who was going through a really terrible, grueling medical ordeal. As a reporter, I had learned to be skeptical about medical breakthroughs and miracles, but as a patient, I had to be a believer. So I put my faith in the science, the numbers, the statistics. And for support, I had Tom, who I call Zuli, and he was a huge comfort to me.
Somewhere along the line, without saying anything, I think we sort of decided when I got sick or something that we just sort of called a truce or something, you know, each of us did or something. And we, like, almost never fight now. I mean, we just kind of, both of us just sort of pretty much kind of let things just slide. You know, if I'm pissed off about something, I just sort of say, oh, well, and he does the same, I think.
Of course, we did have our moments.
If you get upset at me and want me to leave, just tell me to leave.
I don't want you to leave, Zuli, but this is not about you, so just
I know
keep your ego
about
in
me.
Check.
I'm not talking about my ego. I'm telling you, if you want me, don't sit there and just sulk and glare at me. Just tell me to leave, okay?
All right, I will.
I just kind of want him to take care of me, and you know, he's I think he really has sort of in a lot of ways, or he's learning to kind of just put his ego aside and do it, you know, just kind of take care of me. I think it's really hard for him.
You know, she actually said something at that point that was kind of enlightening to me, and that was that maybe she needs somebody to get mad at, you know, to focus her negative or her hostility or, you know, her anger about what's happening to her. So that was actually an illuminating moment for me because that, you know, I can understand that.
January 16th. My 5 days of chemo are over.
You hear that beep? Well, anyway, that... Can I have my nurse, please? That is the last bag of my last day of the last chemo
ever
in this hospital, and hopefully ever.
No.
January 20th. It's a big day for Bill Clinton, and for me, too. He's being sworn in for his second term. I'm getting my stem cells back. They call it day zero because the recovery starts here. Tom and Dan keep trying to get me to say something profound like, getting my stem cells back is like getting my life back. It's true, without these stem cells, I would die. The chemo wiped out my body's ability to make blood cells. But I'm feeling too lousy to wax poetic.
I feel nauseous. My stomach hurts. I don't feel like I want to do this. I feel too rotten.
This is just dry ice.
It's all very anticlimactic. Kathy brings my stem cells up from the deep freeze in a Playmate cooler, like she's ready for a beer at the beach.
Okay, we've got Rebecca B. Pearl, 712792.
I'll take
5 for the first hour.
She thaws out the bags of stem cells like you would a frozen chicken breast and infuses them back into my body through the catheter.
Here they come.
I'm groggy and half asleep for most of it. When I come to, I hear Clinton.
Fellow citizens, we must not waste the precious gift of this time. For all of us are on that same journey of our lives.